Hey, everybody. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. I guess today's bass player and business analyst, Eric Garland, is going to talk a little bit about the business of Guitar Center, which you'll find really interesting. But first, let's talk about a music licensing shakeup that possibly could happen in the next few years. The Copyright Office recently came out with a 245-page report, basically saying that the copyright laws that we have in this country right now are not made for our digital times. They're made, of course, for the last century, and they work perfectly then, but they don't work nearly as well in the digital age. So the report actually suggested four different things. And now all of these things have been discussed before independently, but it's the first time that the Copyright Office has actually come out on one side or another. So here's what they suggested. The first thing is artists should get paid for airplay. Now, believe it or not, whenever a song plays on the radio, the artist does not get paid. The composer gets paid, publisher gets paid, but the artist gets nothing. And this is the only country in the world where that's the case. So as a result, you can have people with huge hits, and I think the Righteous Brothers, You've Got That Loving Feeling, has the most airplays of any song ever, and they never made a dime off of it. The most airplays is something like 18 million or something. It's huge, and they never made a dime off that. Of course, they made it off of everything else. They made some off of sales and touring, but nothing came from the radio airplay. So this is unfair, mostly because, again, all the other countries in the world will do this. And the reason why it hasn't happened so far is because broadcasters have a very effective lobbyist called the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, who have lobbied Congress forever, basically saying the broadcast industry will fail if this happens. And of course, they're making billions of dollars, so this is far from the truth. So this would be a really good law if it were passed. Here's the second thing they suggested. There's a loophole in the copyright law that basically says broadcasters do not have to pay composers for songs written before 1972. So what that means is all of the songs that you hear just about everywhere, if they were written before 1972, the composers are not getting money on them, which, of course, is very unfair. And there's been a number of lawsuits that have come up over this in the last few years. The biggest one is Flo and Eddie and the Turtles, where they've actually won several judgments and lost on appeal. And I think it'll end up going to the Supreme Court that will figure this out. But that being said, the Copyright Office came out and said, look, this is unfair, and we agree. A songwriter should get paid for whenever he wrote the song, not necessarily if it's after 1972. Of course, that doesn't apply to most people that are listening. But on the other hand, it's something that's of interest because it does affect some of your favorite artists and songwriters. Here's a third thing they suggested. There's something called the consent decree that basically sets the rate that ASCAP and BMI and CSAC can charge broadcasters. And the reason for that is they don't want one of those PROs to have an advantage. That sounds good on the surface. The big problem there is the fact that they rarely change that rate. So right now, everybody who's in music publishing is saying, wait a second, the rate hasn't changed with the times. And in fact, we should be getting more. And we can't even renegotiate it. Basically, there's a board that meets every 5 years and then we'll make a change in the rate. What ended up happening was the Copyright Board came out and said, we don't think this is fair either. There should be a better way to do this. And what this might do is actually open up direct deals with a broadcaster. So a major publisher can make a deal. And that sort of happened, actually. Sony ATV has done that and then has been beaten down saying, wait a second, you went around us and that's not legal. So there's a lot of publishers that would like to do this, and big ones especially can probably get away with it. So that's number three. Number four, it says producers should have their royalties paid through Sound Exchange. Right now, if you're a producer and you have points on an album, which you do, you can get paid two ways, by the record label or by the artist. So consider this. If you're supposed to get, well, let's just say 4 points, and it becomes $10,000. Well, the record label will get that $10,000, And whenever they get around to paying you, they get around to paying you. And it keeps on getting longer and longer and longer. And everyone complains that it's 6 months till they get paid. Well, the record label doesn't like to actually pay producers. So what they've done in quite a number of years now is change it over and say to the artist, you are responsible for paying the producer. So this is even worse for the producer, because what happens is the money may never even get to the artist because expenses will be recouped. So what ends up happening is, as with most artists, they don't make too much money off their record deal. And as a result, they can't pay the producer. So the way to get around this is to have an independent third party actually collect the money. And that's Sound Exchange. And Sound Exchange is a PRO for online. It's run by the government. And it seems like it's the fairest of all of the other PROs. So those are the four changes. And should any one of those come down, it'll make a big deal. And if all four come down, it's going to be huge. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. And don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Just go to 101mixingtricks.com and you can find out a whole lot more. And you know what? I'll even give you four free tricks. So the next thing I want to talk about is a new audio format. Now, of course, we have lots of audio formats. We have AIFF, we have WAVE, we have MLP, we have MP3, we have AAC, and you can go on and on and on. There's probably a dozen more. Why do we need another one? Well, this one is a little bit different. It's from a company called Meridian Audio. Meridian makes very, very high-end gear, especially like analog-digital converters, digital-analog converters, things like that. And they were also responsible for MLP, Meridian Lossless Packing, which was the codec that was used on the DVD audio disc 15 years ago when it was happening. Well, they've come out with something that they called MQA, for Master Quality Authentic. And what's unique about this is that it's a lossless codec that's folded into an MP3. So basically what happens is with an MP3, you can have the very, very low-fi of the MP3, but within the same file, you can also have this MQA file. So it will unfold to a lossless FLAC file or ALAC file. And this is pretty fantastic for a couple of reasons. First of all, you can have high-quality audio in a very small file size. The next thing this is good for is the fact that it makes high-quality streaming very easy. And in fact, what we're seeing online is there are services that are adopting this already. One is called 7Digital. 7Digital is out of the UK, and what they do is they offer high-res downloads, so you can get high-quality downloads from your favorite artist. Another one is Tidal, and we've talked about Tidal here before. Tidal is a streaming service. And what's happening with Tidal is they're the first one to actually offer high-quality audio streaming. High-quality meaning CD quality. Well, the way they can do this is because they're using MQA. There's a couple little things also with MQA that are kind of interesting. The first thing is, if you have a piece of gear, audio gear, playback gear, and it has a MQA codec in it, a decoder, and you play an authenticated file, a little green LED will come on telling you, guess what? This is the real file. It's not one that's copied. It's not one that's not authentic. It's the one that the artist and record label intended. So that's kind of cool. The other thing that's interesting, especially for record labels, is the fact that it lowers their inventory. Although inventory isn't all that big a deal, it's in terms of size when it comes to digital, it's more of a problem just keeping track of it. So now if you can have an MP3 and a high quality FLAC file, let's say, within the same small file, that just makes everything easier. And obviously if it's easier in the digital domain, the artist is more likely to get paid. So this might be exciting. I don't know if it'll catch on, but so far there's some buzz about it. So we'll see. It's called MQA, Master Quality Authentic, and we'll see in the coming months whether it's going to be the next big thing or not. Guitar Center has been in the news a lot, and the person mostly responsible for that is bass player and analyst Eric Garland. Eric's day gig is consulting for major corporations about the latest business and marketing trends. And a year or so back, he spotted some irregularities in Guitar Center's profit and loss statement. So he posted what he thought was going to happen, and it basically led him to the conclusion that the way Guitar Center did business was unsustainable. His latest post predicts the end is near for Guitar Center, and it's really stoked the firestorm one more time. So I spoke with Eric from his studio in St. Louis via Skype. I had bronchitis when I did this, so if I sound a little funny or cough a little bit, that's why. Eric, thank you so much for being with me today. I've been looking forward to talking with you for quite a while now.
Likewise, pleasure is going to be all mine.
Tell me about Competitive Futures, first of all.
Competitive Futures is a consulting firm that does strategic analysis, competitive analysis for corporate and government executives about future economic trends and the things that will cause them, such as social trends, technology, all that, politics occasionally. And I like to say, I read the news so you don't have to. We read the news, count the numbers, and we tell you what it means, more or less.
So how did you get there from being a bass player? Or is being a bass player a byproduct? How did that work?
It's funny you ask. I consider musician as my longest career, and in many ways my most important. It's been a little quiet here now, living in my wife's hometown of St. Louis, but I played professionally in the Scottish and Irish Celtic scenes in the Northeast and toured doing that. And when I settled in Washington, D.C., for my side project, my fallback plan of being a strategic analyst and a futurist working for big organizations, you know, that was my fallback plan. I also played salsa professionally in D.C. as a bass player. So that's, you know, been the longer term deal. So, you know, I take it very seriously. I keep practicing and make sure my gear sounds good and whatnot. And this subject we're going to discuss today has just kind of been an unusual coincidence as these two parts of my life slap together.
Yeah, it's really unusual that there's actually someone like you available, someone who has credibility as a musician, plus you're a real analyst, where most people are kind of fake in this. So anyway, let's talk about Guitar Center. And you have an interesting take on Guitar Center. You've had several, actually, but the last one has been causing quite a bit of furor. One that I agree with, and that's that we're seeing the end of GC right now.
We're definitely seeing the end of its current phase. As I look back through the company's history, I wouldn't say there's a lot in the company of 1993, even with the same brand name and trademarks as now. You know, I think this is one of the illusions that the financial sector is able to come up with in order to lull us into thinking that we're looking at the same companies. And if their scheme of the moment doesn't work, then that's the end of business. It's the end of capitalism. It's the end of this company. You know, I suspect even that the brand name Guitar Center will be around. So I don't think it's the end of Guitar Center per se. It's the end of this phase of Guitar Center having been jumped up on steroids by private equity bankers who are going to stuff millions of dollars of securities that pay out 10 to 15% in the vault that they don't tell anybody about. And then they put some other debt out to the public and just try and run the whole thing and act like they're in charge of the universe. That's done. And I'm not sure I'm going to miss it that much.
It's the end of the big box Guitar Center then, right? Big box universe of Guitar Center.
Certainly, the way I've been seeing it is that the end of a phase of American urban and commercial development that started in the late 1990s in many ways, with the exuberance of having defeated the dreaded Soviet Union bloodlessly in the Cold War. And have, you know, America in the 90s went through this incredible, incredible period of economic expansion based on particularly the early hits of information technology investments hitting our business sector, particularly management systems, consumer electronics. And, you know, we got even wealthier than we had in the prior decade. And we had this special angle that in the mid-1990s, you had the entire communist system had come apart. They had been the major ideological competitor of the United States, and a serious one for decades. One people considered maybe that would be better. Everywhere from, East Germany all the way to North Korea. You know, maybe this communism thing's got some legs to it. And then a few years later, then it didn't. And everyone was like, well, the Russians are done. The empire's done here. So we've got to find another way to do business. Well, who knows how to do business? The Americans, baby. We had, we had air conditioning. We had cars that worked. We had all this great stuff. And you have these companies, or these countries, that had entire economies that didn't do accounting. I mean, they'd been just literally up to their necks in fraud for decades, because that's how communist, economies actually worked. The old joke being, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. Ha ha ha. And more than, there were many factors that led to the downfall of the communist system in the Soviet Empire. But mostly it was, they were cooking the books. It's never good for your organization, and you can fake it with PR for a while. But it runs out eventually. And that's what happened with the Soviet Union. And America was the only game in town. I've published some business books. And I found out when I published my first with the American Management Association that 95% of business books were written by American authors. We represent 4% of the population of the globe, 95% of the business books. And it's like, surely there are commercial minds out there in Bulgaria and in France and Sweden and the Philippines. There's sharp people all over the world. There's survivors. They're natively geniuses. They're all over. We're 95% of the business community because we had the goods to show for it, man. We had Huey Lewis records and Blue Jeans and the Plymouth K car. We had it all. And so that's what got sold into the communists, is they had been told by their propaganda systems how corrupt we were. And then they were getting glimmers. I think those guys are not doing as badly as we're being told. And when the whole thing came down, who was going to come in and teach you how to do generally accepted accounting principles? The Americans, Anderson Consulting and, McKinsey, and they went into Russia and we brought that, and we dominated the world. And then in terms of our business techniques and thought processes. And then in the late 1990s, this other streak came in. We've done so well with finance because we have a fairly stable financial sector. These guys do so great. We got to let them. They're like perfect little flowers. We got to let them bloom. We got to let them become this next phase. So let's not stifle them from innovating. Let's take apart Glass-Steagall, the Glass-Steagall Act, which separates the casino bankers, the investment guys, the speculators, and the dudes who run the checkbooks and the savings accounts. Let them run. Surely this will turn out well. Oh, wait a minute. We actually, last time we didn't. No, it's going to work out great. And hey, we have this new class of investment vehicles called derivatives. But it's not like insurance or anything. Like, actually, it doesn't even really need to be regulated. So if you can just let them, it'll be in the back room, but don't worry about that. And that was under Clinton. That a lot of people take a look at what happened under Bush and they blame that on Bush. Well, some of the major, major pillars that happened under the late years of Bill Clinton, when Bob Rubin and Larry Summers came in, and they said, let Wall Street handle these derivatives. It's going to work out fine. And that unclenched, particularly once the dot-com boom, went bust, but you still have all these baby boomers. They got to put their money somewhere to retire. All that capital flows into the financial sector. And it's got to go somewhere. So when the first phase of dot-com drops out, where's the next bubble going to go? Well, you got a few policies that are in place. You've got fair housing acts, man. We need to get more people into it as homeowners. Of course, if you go back as Selma, the movie is in theaters as we're having this podcast. One of the major sticking points were there were red line mortgage rules at banks not to sell homes to poor minorities.
Yeah.
We're going to measure how many people we can get into owning their own home. But there's a risk inherent, with people that don't have great credit. Well, we have these derivatives around that's going to hedge the risk automagically. Oh, man, this is going to be great. And now all these people can own homes and we've got more capital. We're going to flood the world with cheap liquidity. But it's okay. This is not more risk because we got these derivatives. That's all good. And now people can move into bigger homes. And they can now take out lines of credit against those homes. And they can purchase items for those homes. And where are those homes going to be? Are they going to be in the city centers that we kicked to the curb during the first civil rights movement? No, let's still do it way away from town. And, well, we don't want them to have to drive all the way into Cleveland or St. Louis or Phoenix. We'll put the retail out there in huge boxes. And, you know, it just happened to be at the moment the private equity was really ramping up. And you look at, I'm blanking on the name of the PE firm, if it was Cerebras or one of them, you know, created Home Depot out of thin air. They're like, let's run the table, guys. We'll put all this Wall Street thing, all Wall Street capital together. We'll make something bigger than anyone's ever seen. And then we'll be able to command better deals with the vendors and the real estate and the this and the that. And we'll just do it all. And we'll drop prices. Everyone will love it. And then we'll drop margins on the vendors. And everyone will love it. And we'll drop prices. And we'll pay the bonuses to us. It'll work great. And it does for a while. And then the real elements start to show, the real implications, where they have taken, in the case of Home Depot, and I think you see a very strong echo of this with what's going on with Guitar Center. With Home Depot, you know, they push manufacturing from the United States to China, from China to Vietnam. They push that number down. Now, you guys need to sharpen your pencils. We need 11% off this year. You wouldn't want us to order from someone else now, would you? It'd be real difficult for you if you had dropped, because now we're 48% of your, you know, distribution. And anyone knows when that much of your business is one client, it's real question about who's buying from whom.
Well, and that's exactly the problem with Guitar Center. That's exactly the case. There you go.
Why, I believe it is. Yes.
That's right.
And they got in the act, about 3 to 4 years after. So if you think there's going to be a pioneer in this, and Walmart has a bit of a different model. The more I learn about Walmart, there's a different level of intelligence going on there that in some ways is more real, you know, in the sense of I heard they're making their own lines of container ships at a certain level of energy efficiency to be able to make the run between the port of Shenzhen and the port of San Pedro in California.
Wow.
That's the level they're thinking at.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's kind of nobody like Walmart out there thinking the way they do. You know, they don't own stock. You own stock and you pay to have it in their stores. And the moment that it, you know, the transaction takes place, when you bring that peanut butter up to Walmart, they buy it from Jif and then you buy it from them. It's an IT play. They're on another level of the universe, man.
They're getting a royalty, essentially, if you think about it.
That's a good way of looking at it. They're getting a royalty. Yeah. I like that. They're the streaming MP3. They're really Spotify, but for peanut butter. I love that.
Well, getting back to Guitar Center here, which I know that's where you're going anyway, I remember Guitar Center when it was one store, when it first started. It was on Sunset Boulevard. It was across the street from where the main Sunset Boulevard Guitar Center is now. And it was a mom and pop store.
Wow.
And they specialized in guitars, and it was a great place. And it was almost like overnight where all of a sudden they grew up. And what you started to see were different branches of Guitar Center opening up around Southern California, and then it became a completely different entity. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, anytime an organization goes to a certain, let's say, order of magnitude, there's a culture change. And it's often a painful one because you have certain values that are focused around, you know, family operations. And, you know, there's a lot of lament for the mom and pop, you know, that, well, people that just run their own stores. Well, you know, small towns across this great land of ours have been, you know, filled with megalomaniacal douchebags that run small empires in small places and who are just as venal and corrosive to their local community as a large entity can be to a large entity, you know, so large entities do not have the lock on being, you know, being problematic or being having immoral behavior or what have you. But what'll often happen is when you get up to, you know, a guy has a store, he opens a second one uptown, then this is working pretty well. So he goes 3, 4, 5. And when he gets to 10, all of a sudden that culture of him and his wife and his kid and whatever, he starts getting out of his depth, and or he or she get out of their depth, and they go, we got to have some, we have to have some managerial, you know, talent up in here who can tell us how to do this on this scale. And it begins, you know, well, this is how it's being done right now. Okay, well, we'll do that. And all of a sudden now we have a lunch policy now, guys. It's not just you go get some food. Lunches will be on a, you know, a 30-minute, blah, 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 or it'll be 45 minutes. You must be back by this because we got it. Because now, you know, we can't be in every store. There's 6 stores now, so we got to do that. Sorry. And some stuff gets better, and some, you know, maybe the pay goes up and you share in a bonus plan that's a bigger pool. But then it's going really well, and there's a, you know, you have a bit of a recession, and then it pops up again. You know, post-war, we're used to post-war recessions to explain away times when things get bad. Mm. This will feature in our future discussion here. Most people are used to an up and down sine wave to explain the business cycle. But realistically, that's only been a commonality since, you know, the 1940s in the United States. Mm. It's very typical to our post-war, largely peaceful business cycle. But when it comes back up, now that six store chain becomes 20. Maybe it goes to 50. And once you get to a certain level, it depends on the managerial talent that you get in. You know, you have a chance to go nationwide. And you see this, we've seen this in fast food. You have places like Chick-fil-A that are huge. They're very dominant in certain regions, predominantly the South. And then they start expanding and they, you know, something runs up against, you know, there's some resistance. In the case of Chick-fil-A, you have, you know, company culture, and I'm not here to make a comment on it. I love their chicken sandwiches, or, you know, despite whatever they may feel about my gay friends. But, you know, they, you know, have a very outspoken feeling about the legalization of gay marriage, and they strap that to their brand. Well, it keeps them, you're going to be kind of in the NASCAR districts for the people that really don't care about that. And you'll have, you know, Krispy Kreme or McDonald's or whoever, they go global. And that's really a question of management. My understanding of Guitar Center's history is you had, you know, the one store, the local, the regional, and somewhere around the late 90s and to early 2000s, particularly the late 90s, that's when it's like, we're going nationwide, baby. Because this is the trend. You know, there's no reason not to. And we've got the, you know, we got the best brand and the best stroke and the best managers, and we're in LA and we're going to export this out. And, you know, I'll say I was a customer then. There's something that people, you know, there have been people who've made the mistaken assumption that I've been this lifelong big box hater or Guitar Center hater. I'm like, well, you know, I did give them $8,000 over like 5 years or something in that neighborhood. I bought Mark-based bass amps and, you know, Roland guitar synths and all sorts of cool stuff. And, you know, largely enjoyed the experience, though towards the last few years, I couldn't help but notice the differences in the inventory, the differences in the skill level of the people. And, of course, as I've told in a few different venues, you know, the way I ended up becoming this figure, talking about them in a very public way, was I was at a jam session in St. Louis, and a guitarist who really follows the industry much closer than I ever did says to me that, did you hear Guitar Center is a junk bond? And I said, really? What the hell are they doing with all the money I keep giving them? I go in there, I always walk out with something. What are they doing? And I didn't think too much about it until it was Thanksgiving of 2013. And I walked into my local Guitar Center and I sat down and I started playing a Ernie Ball John Petrucci model. Forget what amp I was plugged into, but I was having a groovy little time, having fun. And I looked around and I saw all the dudes in the red t-shirts were like they were the temp labor they were bringing in for the Mongol hordes that were going to just buy all the strats in the universe. And nobody was in there but me. And a few Saturday, you know, tire kickers and, you know, look, Jimmy, do you like ukulele? And I just, you know, my parents are both in retail. My dad's run a farm store for 40 years. My mom had a pie shop and my uncle had an appliance shop, and I could go on. And I know how retail works. And I just looked around and in my eyes, I counted up the overhead and I looked and I went, this is the busiest day of the year. Ooh. And I went back to home. And that's when I got on and Googled their bond rating. Mm-hmm. And I saw the excerpt from Reuters, and I said, whoa, they're hosed. Because my day job, I look at that stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. How's a company doing? How's a national economy doing? The numbers have to make sense at one point. And when I saw $1.6 billion for a $2 billion company, what are their short-term liabilities? Like, what do they owe in a big lump check, like, in a couple of years? $153 million?
Yeah,
$953 million after that? What is it? I'm like, how much are they at? They're cooked. And, you know, so I got on and this was the Saturday after Thanksgiving. No one ever paid attention to my blog for musical instrument industry insights ever. I'd never made a public comment on it. And I thought, this is everyone's, you know, flopped over watching whatever bowl game and they're, you know, they got a gravy stain down their face. No one cares. So I just had Guitar Center and the end of big box retail because I have been tracking Sears and Radio Shack. And I've been tracking the retail sector as a whole as part of an explanation of why things in this economy don't look like a recovery. I've said for a long time, it's a transition, not a recovery. Because America has, and I think it's the numbers coming down pretty rapidly, 23 square feet of retail per capita. France has 2.
Wow.
Italy has 1. Britain has 2. Sweden, with those IKEA stores, has 3. We have 23.
Wow.
And much of that was built out during the whole fiesta of debt and mortgage, you know, nonsense. And it's going to shrink. No, we still got growth. We're going to grow. It's going to be okay. We love growth. The growth. The only organism that insists on growing all the time is the cancer cell. And when, you know, we exited the catastrophe of 2008, and some of us not exiting with their money intact as much as some other sectors like the finance sector who had been put back on their feet by, you know, policy fiat. But when we got out of that, there was this mass hallucination of, well, it's all going to be okay now and we'll just get back to growth. It's like, are you kidding? We just blew an enormous bubble. It's going to come back down. It's going to suck. It's going to hurt. Because that's what happens after you make stupid mistakes. It takes a while. That's the adult reality of these things. And so, you know, my operating conclusion, looking at, I mean, Radio Shack just filed for bankruptcy the other day. JCPenney has been, that body's been twitching for, you know, for weeks. And Sears is a mess. And it's, you know, retail's shifting and it, you know, and we overbuilt. You know, there's just more PetSmarts than, you know, the universe really requires. And that's okay. You know, in capitalism, it's not all, you know, winning, you know, at the blackjack table, the dealer does win occasionally. You will have your losses and your wins. And if you're smart, you end up walking out, you know, hopefully cash flow positive. Business isn't a whole lot different. You will make, you know, individually and as a group, some good decisions and some decisions you wish you could take back. Blowing retail and housing up to make it look like there was growth. When wage growth stopped in the year 2000, we haven't had wage growth for the average American in 15 years. Now, if you're in the top 100th of 1% or the top 1/10th of 1%, you've had wage and wealth growth. Your relative income and how much your share of everything is, you've had a fantastic few years. But if you make money, people give you money because you do something, you're flatlined. Possibly since the 1980s, if you look at it in a certain angle, and definitely outside of debt, the GDP growth outside of debt we've taken on has been flat for 15 years. And, you know, retail has been a huge part of the illusion. You know, we couldn't do it through honest growth. So we did it through financial trickery. We did it through derivatives. We did it through, you know, this maniacal growth. And it has, you know, consequences.
And this is obviously, that's where Guitar Center was, not only where it was headed, where the evolution that it went through. I have a question. So Bain got involved. Why did that happen? Bain got him to get to go private. Why did they go to Bain? Do you know?
I actually don't have any insight as to why they chose Bain and not one of the many other, BlackRock or, but why did they end up going private? I have read other people's analysis, so I can't speak to it with great strength, But I've read other people's analysis that the insiders at the company were worried about having to report quarterly numbers, and that to be take it back private again would allow them to perhaps get back to growth in their own way, and they could take a negative quarter without it eviscerating everyone's wealth from the stock and things like that. So the problem, and I pointed this out in my latest article, The End of Guitar Center, the problem is that really that private equity type scheme of we're gonna buy you, we're gonna jack you full of debt that is at a really high rate of interest for us, and then we're going to spit you out back into the public's warm and welcoming arms, also known as the dumb money. We can get that done in about 3 to 5 years, and we'll make it look good, and we'll fire some people, and we'll hide, you know, the ugliness. And by the time, you know, by the time it's a public stock, you know, we'll be on the beach. We'll be in St. Bart's, man. We'll be in Monaco. Doesn't matter. That had only happened a few years prior. And as I like to say with these types of matters, what you need to make chicken casserole is chicken. You need raw chicken to cook to make chicken casserole. You don't make chicken casserole out of chicken casserole. This company had already been taken in that direction. That had just happened 3 to 5 years, you know, a few years before that. They went public in 2002. They had 5 years in, and then all of a sudden Bain's like, yeah, we're going to do it again. Months before the whole game comes apart, the wheels come off the fun bus in 08. So yeah. they levered this thing up just before the biggest financial crisis in 100 years. And my firm had predicted it, and we didn't get particularly famous for it, and no one gives you, you don't necessarily get a lot of accolades for telling people something they don't want to hear. But, you know, we had a model where we were looking at the total number of mortgages that were utterly garbage, that were, negative amortization based on adjustable rates that were about to adjust. And yeah. We're like, wait a minute, at that rate, that's going to blow everything up. And so if I had been smart, I don't want to meddle. If I'd been smart, I'd have started my own hedge fund and I would be in Monaco hanging out.
Yeah, there you go. Well, okay, so Bain comes in and then takes them private at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. And then they try to do their typical thing to get out of it. And then they run into a problem because all of a sudden money's tight because we're in a financial downward spiral. Okay, so they turn around and they get Ares involved, right? Ares Capital.
Eventually they do, yes.
Eventually they do. And then it's still not going well for them. So Bain and Ares get together and then they sell some bonds, right? To try to mitigate the upcoming balloon payments that are happening, right? To try to get in front of them, right? Correct. Okay.
You're talking about the transactions of March and April of 2014.
Yeah. So what I don't understand is why would anybody buy these bonds?
The answer is baby boomers. The answer is retirement. And you have pension funds that need yield. And I mentioned this in an article I wrote entitled How to Get Beyond the Parasite Economy, where when I'd been watching going, all right, this is, you know, there's going to be some major handoff here. Maybe it's the end, or maybe it's just going to look ugly. And it was something that just looked ugly if you knew what you were looking at, where I believe Bain got its equity crammed down and they retired a bunch of their pick notes. And that means they won't be getting paid to some degree. And Ares did the same in exchange for equity. It's hard, by the way, it's really hard to track all these by design. I can tell you how Exxon is financed. A huge company.
Yeah.
Second biggest in the world or second biggest in America anyhow. I can tell you how their business works. I even put that up as an example in my Parasite Economy article, because it's like it's an enormous enterprise, way bigger than Guitar Center. But you can read its financial statements. It just makes sense. It's like here's what we sold in products. Here's our cost structure. Here's SG&A. Here's blah, blah, blah. Taxes, depreciation. That's how it went. We made $56 billion in profit this quarter.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, right.
Merry Christmas. That's what we did. And then Guitar Center, because you've got all these layers of, you know, their bonds are what are called, they're under Rule 144A, which is they don't have to be reported if it's between two private equity firms. If it's between two firms, they don't have to go to the public. It is allowed to happen under the dark. Now, you'd assume that, well, surely that there's a government watchdog that's keeping track of that. Sure. They get to name their own regulators these days. That's what happened after 2008. They're like, no. We're not losing. The taxpayers are losing. We get our companies back. You're paying for our assets. We're taking our bonuses this year. And the guy who's going to be in charge of legal enforcement is going to be an ex-vice president of Goldman Sachs. Oh, wow. And the woman who's going to be the next head of SEC, she's going to be our former defense attorney for J.P. Morgan. That's how it's going to go, America. Wow. And it did. And we all sat there and smiled. So that's good because we like normalcy. But so why does anyone look at this story and go, well, who would buy that company? Well, if they're going to promise 9.6% yield, there's some bond fund manager out there who's trying to put something together for your grandma, for your mom, for you, for, you know, well, we need yield, and it's a zero interest rate environment. So we're not getting it from, you know, treasuries and other places. So we have to get it somewhere. And these high yield bonds have this interesting characteristic where the risk is not seen as risk. It's just how it is, right? Just like in the mortgage business, they took people that didn't have jobs. They took people that did not have any, you know, they had any business owning a $400,000 home, and they called them a good risk. And they had the bond age, or they had the ratings agencies cover for them and say, oh, it's AAA, it's prime stuff. And it wasn't. It wasn't. It was just a way to hustle money out of the system. And we're great, and we didn't punish them for it. So it's no wonder that in 2014 and 15, they're still doing the same stuff. Wouldn't you? If you have a bully in school and he never gets his ass kicked, he does what he does until somebody stops him.
Okay, so GC's in this predicament because of financial engineering, essentially. They fell prey to the talons of Wall Street, so to speak. And I understand why. Everybody wants to cash out. Everybody wants to make some dough. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, obviously it's people like you and me who are buying stuff at Guitar Center, mm-hmm. who, and the poor people that work at Guitar Center, and you know, I have no love for a lot of the people that are there because, let me say that again. A lot of the people that are there, unfortunately, are there for the wrong reason as salespeople, and you know, that's a problem in itself. All that being said, what's going to happen? What do you see? If you look in the crystal ball, what do you see happening?
Well, I don't think I could have said it much stronger than they're done. This is it. This scheme is absolutely unmanageable.
Right, but what's going to happen? So they're going to declare bankruptcy at some point, right?
Correct.
Then what's going to happen? They're going to start to sell off stores?
Now we are starting to get close to the event horizon. So the way I describe this system that you can see in a variety of individual firms or national economies, you could see it at play in the Soviet Union's entire economic system. It's called collapse dynamics. And you have an event horizon where you're going to get into a period of time where the amount of time between major shifts in the system reduces. That's part of why I've been, you know, made stronger and stronger calls on Guitar Center, because the amount of time between their problems, major problems, keeps reducing. You know, and you've got, you know, I just made an offhand comment in December 2013, and their CEO, Mike Pratt, came to yell at me on my Facebook page that I owed all their employees' families an apology.
Yeah.
You know, their vice president of communications yelled at me because I didn't give him an interview prior to writing on my own blog, because that's how the internet works in 2013.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said to myself, this is an overreaction. Somebody's hiding something here. And so I just waited around and kept a good eye on it. And then in March, you know, the reorganization happens. And in, you know, late March, it's like, well, we got all the bonds out. It's okay. We crammed down some equity. You know, we've reduced the, you know, the value of the company by $300 billion. that was going to be, you know, Bane's take home. And I describe that as it's one of the greatest cases of chutzpah in the history of man, where they said, we've improved our financial position. I'm like, that's like holding a grapefruit and someone comes over and blows your legs off with a cannon. And then you look up at the camera and you go, I just lost 50 pounds on the grapefruit diet. Well, yeah, kind of. But I'm not sure that's exactly what everyone would like to have happen to them. And, you know, so in April they come out, and then by summer, you know, how we... I hear everything's fine. People I talk to around the industry, well, it looks like it's okay. Like, yeah, did you talk to anyone in finance about it? No. Oh, well, then I guess you're taking their word for it. That's fine. And by August, my favorite was, we're going to hit $3 billion in 5 years by 2020. Right. It's our 2020 vision. $3 billion. And we just opened up in the most expensive real estate on earth. Oh, but it's not a cost like to every other retail. It's an ad for their online stores. Don't forget to go, to M&M's. I'm trying to think of Ann Taylor. Don't forget to go to Aeropostale, wherever, you know, online. Because we're not making money here. But we're at this incredibly famous place. Remember our brand.
Yeah, but it's a cost. You're talking about the Times Square store that they opened.
Oh, sure. Yep. Sorry. Yes, yep. The world's most expensive. I suppose Kowloon Bay in Hong Kong is more expensive, technically. Monaco, my old friends in Monaco, it's more expensive.
Yeah.
But their CFO, Tim Martin, came out and said, oh, no, this is not only not a cost. We're going to make, quote, his words, not mine, a lot of money. Oh, yeah, we're going to hit $3 billion by 2020. And this incredibly expensive piece of overhead, this is going to be, man, this is just one of our fantastic projects that's going to happen by 2020. It's going to be amazing. We have a flat economy, flat wages. The Beatles are not on Ed Sullivan this week to bring everybody into the electric guitar age. But we're going to grow 20% year over year after we're already 28% of the entire industry. And probably 50% of the pop music industry.
Well, wait a second.
We're going to grow 20% a year, every year for 5 years, because we said so.
But
okay.
There's a lot of smart people out there in all industries, and it's not my industry, but I got to believe in the finance industry as well. There got to be a lot of smart people out there. How do people not see through this?
Iraq. A whole lot of smart people in Washington, D.C. We marched into... a national embarrassment, a national tragedy. Some of the smartest people you've ever met lied to themselves, lied to other people. Some of them didn't quite believe it, and they knew they, if they didn't get out of the way of that, the way our leadership was going, that they would be crushed. I know plenty of analysts, in national security, who tell me about how the Bush administration went and sat on the desks of 25-year-old analysts who just got out of the Air Force and said, I saw that you said this. Don't you mean this instead? You got a couple choices there. You either turn your badge in and you walk out the door, or you look up at this 60-year-old looking at you, darts in his eyes, and you go, I could change that. Yeah, sure. I mean, how do these systems work? I mean, that's, you know, how do large, very large systems go into such dysfunction? It ought to be, I ought to write a book on that because there's a lot of it going on. I would say that this is exactly what happens when you take a financial sector, you turn them loose on society, and they are able to, you know, take a company that had been, you know, fairly positive in a lot of ways. I know a lot of people who they've contacted me personally since my writing has come out, and they've said, man, I just feel so terrible because I remember when this was a great company.
Yeah. Right.
I love working for them. And they would describe the dates and I'd go, yeah, man, I used to go to your Guitar Center in Rockville, Maryland, outside of D.C., and I liked it. I love Chuck Levin's in Washington, or Chuck Levin's Washington Music in Wheaton. I love Atomic Music in Beltsville, Maryland. I mean, I haunted those places, but I also like Guitar Center. I, you know, spread the love. I didn't, you know, just because they were a nationwide chain. I thought a lot of the old Guitar Center managed to strike this wonderful balance of, yeah, we have a lot of stuff in here, and you know, some of it's beginner and some of it's quite nice. But for some reason, none of us have the attitude that some of the more boutique-y guitar shops can have, of being really, really insufferable jerks about the whole experience. Like, are you in here to buy a $4,000 guitar right now? Like, no, but I've done it in the past. May I play your James Tyler? May I play your John Sir guitar? Guitar Center didn't have it. Hey, take it down. That's cool. Let us know. And, you know, you had some musicians that might have been on tour. They go to Guitar Center. If they sell pretty well, they get some commission. They're feeling pretty good. So a pretty healthy dynamic. But in the boiler room, you have the guys at the top that are looking to cash out. They're looking to they are managing other things about business and life. And it may, you know, it just changes the dynamic. And then, you know, the Bane years are really, collapse dynamics where, you know, an original sin has been committed and no one can really, really fix it. So all these people are smart. Yes. You know, but once you have a $2 billion company, once one person with a high IQ is not the same thing as wisdom. I learned that the hard way. There's a whole lot of intelligent idiots in the world. Once one person locks in a decision, or a group of five people or 20 people lock in a decision, yeah, we're going to lever this company up to $1.6 billion, financed at this horrific rate. And all of a sudden, it ain't the economy it used to be. What is any... You can't smart your way out of that. What do you do?
Yeah. Okay. So the real problem here is... Okay, Guitar Center is cooked, and their name may be around. Someone may come in and buy the brand. That's a distinct possibility. But you know what? In the meantime, there's going to be a lot of ancillary damage in all of this, and that's what worries me. There's a lot of companies that are beholden to Guitar Center because, as you said, they may be 40% of their business. There's a lot of them around, and big and small, and they're going to hurt, and a lot of them are going to go away as a result. That's what I fear.
In 2008, I told you, you know, we had been looking at the financial crisis coming up, and I had three employees, and my office was two blocks from the White House in downtown Washington, and I got them to get their CVs ready because I knew that my company was small enough and young enough that we didn't have the resources to take what would be a major blow. 50% of our clients were fired. The day, within days of the of October 8th, I think is when, you know, the major carnage happened. And by early 2009, it was a higher percentage than that. Of the people that we did business with were gone. And they're like, yeah, we won't be getting budget for 3 years. And, you know, I had a company that was going to hire me to train a staff of analysts of 20. And they called me and they said, we need to rescind that order, actually, because we just fired 18 of them. So. We don't really need you. Oh, okay. And I had to fire my, three employees. The best thing I ever did in my career was I got them gigs before they would hurt. And I did not keep them along for my convenience. I was like, nope, I'm going to be fine. And you guys and some of, a couple of them were younger. And, it's like, you guys got to land on your feet. So we're putting you're over here and I'll make some calls. And we got them all settled. And it was the greatest thing I ever did in my business life. Personally, it was shattering, to have built something with blood, sweat, tears, debt, equity, all that, and to have it, blown away for, what ended up being a couple good years through not a lot of fault of my own. So I clearly didn't do everything correctly, still don't. But, most of that was things were a certain brand of normal. And then this tidal wave hits you and what do you do? What do you do when 75% of the people you just sold to are gone? And now you need to make new connections. And when you do, they're like, oh, that's great, man. We totally have to do some analysis-y stuff. We'll have budget in 2011 or 12. Oh, that's your next. Yeah, that's our current forecast, minimum 2 years before we get a budget for anybody that isn't us. Because we just actually fired 75% of our staff here in the managerial corridor. So it's not going to look good if we then turn around and pay you. Oh, okay. Thanks for the call. Oh, I don't have to look far to think empathetically about what it'll be like if you have made a decision that leads you into the way of this event. And that you'll be damaged by it. I know personally, and I feel for the people who will have that happen. And I will not even stop to gloat to say, well, you should have seen it coming. Well, maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. And, that's the
It's too late for many of them at this point. They're too far into the game to be able to make a change. So, you know, they just have to go with the flow at this point.
Alea jacta est. It's what Julius Caesar said when he crossed the Rubicon. The die is cast. There we go. I have to say, when I was walking around Nam for the first time, and I was as giddy as you'll ever see a person.
Yeah, that's like, great, isn't it?
And everyone said, it'll never be this good. This is the best experience of your life. Don't forget it. I'm like, I can still have unmitigated joy as a 40-year-old. This is awesome. I mean, I get to meet 80% of my bass heroes. I got to hang out. I'm playing a bass at the Federa shop, and Victor Wooten appears over your left shoulder. I mean, and you know, I got to shoot the breeze with Alain Caron in Canadian French, which is where I'm from, and I just, you know, it couldn't have been any better. Hey, sure, Brian Bromberg, show me your new bass. I agree, they are awesome. This is an amazing value for $1,400. You are correct. Wow, thanks, Brian Bromberg. Loved it. Yeah. Personally. And then, so that was 50% of my brain is just geeking out on that. And then the other 50% was taking in information about, okay, do these guys know what's coming next? And there was a profound sense of normalcy bias of, well, we do this every year.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe so. And that's, I've been doing this kind of analysis for leaders around the world for long enough that I've gone well past the, you know, you're an idiot, you should have thought it my way, or no, you know, I'm more into the science of it, and this is a sociological science. What does it take for us to make decisions? What does it take for those, or actually, what does it take to change our perception of the world? And from that changing perception, can we share that with people in a complex system? And at what point does that become a different action? And what are the ramifications of that? I mean, we have only been running institutions at the scale, 266 stores at a time. This is new in history. You know, businesses have been for a long time more ephemeral. They come and they go. They are based on relationships. They are based on personalities. History, if you read it, history doesn't like empires. Not really. It likes diversity. It likes complex adaptive systems that are bloody and messy. One of the public intellectuals who's done some of the best work on this has been Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who is a financier himself, and who made boatloads of money off 2008 because he saw ahead in ways other people did not about fat tail risk from complexity coming apart at the last minute. Mm-hmm. But the example of an industry that really, that benefits from chaos, what he calls anti-fragility. You have fragility, the ability to break apart very easily. And then you have robustness, which is it'll take a hit and you won't destroy it all the way. And you have anti-fragility, things that improve from shocks, that the worse you treat it, the better they get. And, he's really doing some of the newest philosophy and the newest practical philosophy that we've maybe seen in centuries. You know, people's opinions of him vary, and he certainly doesn't suffer fools gladly on Twitter, but this stuff he's doing matters a whole lot. And in terms of anti-fragility, he gives us an example of an industry where this matters. He gives the restaurant scene, the restaurant business, restaurants in New York, restaurants in LA. If you know how the business works, it's brutal. You start a business, you start a restaurant for the wrong reason. You start without the requisite knowledge. Oh, you didn't know how your vendors worked. You were getting old and you were letting them give you old and crappy vegetables. You didn't know the best fish purveyor. You didn't know who needs an extra cocktail for free when he comes in to visit. You didn't know that? Oh, you're out of business. This is, you know, your mistakes are not covered by anyone. Because there isn't one restaurant co. There's a complex adaptive network of chefs, of maitre d's, of owners, of investors, and they all get in the game parallel to each other, and it's chaos. And as a result, you have people sometimes run two or three restaurants into the ground until they start really hitting it, because they understand more about the system. And they've got, in many cases, you'll have somebody that fails at one restaurant, so they have to go someplace where they're a better fit, where they, you know, their talent is developed. And this is a very, very rich, fast-moving, ridiculous, human situation that involves cocaine and coming in hungover and getting fired and throwing pans if you've ever worked in the restaurant industry.
I owned a restaurant. I've been there. So, yeah.
The choir.
No kidding. No kidding.
Restaurants in New York City, for example, took a major hit in the face when the financial sector went down in 08. And it stripped them down to basics. You know, the white tablecloths flew off. Are you used to making your margin on $1,000 bottles of wine for these douche nozzles? Well, guess what? You need to get on the phone. You need to get a real wine guy in here who will tell you how to make something get delicious bottles that'll be $45 or $85. Massive shock. It put a lot of people out of business. And are restaurants gone in New York? No, it's incredible. You have food trucks, Brooklyn, you got this and that. Food is exploding all over San Francisco, L.A., humble St. Louis.
So you see that happening in the music business then when the crap hits the fan with GC here?
When the defecation hits the ventilation, yes, sir. There is going to be, people won't stop playing guitar. I gave an interview to British Music Industry News magazine talking about Fender, because people said, well, hey, if you know about Guitar Center, maybe you know something about Fender. Yeah. Quite a leap of faith. But they were asking me what I thought of the move to direct, of them going direct. I said, it's clearly radical. It's clearly a radical move. But this is an iconic brand. And I believe 30 years from now, the electric guitar will certainly be around. And someone, somewhere, will see archival footage on YouTube or whatever the social media video platform that goes into your contact lenses will be, I suppose. They will see archival footage of Jimi Hendrix humping his Strat into a screaming Marshall, slamming it onto the ground and setting it on fire and coaxing the spirits of the universe out of it. And someone will purchase a Fender Stratocaster not long after that event takes place. This is not going to go away, and a lot of the hysteria you get is very deliberate on behalf of, the interested parties. Well, you're talking about putting a lot of people out of work. And it's very funny. People talk to me about this, and there's this kind of assumption like I'm making it happen rooting for it to happen. I'm an analyst. I could be shut up at any, from Guitar Center's corporate perspective, I could be shut up at any moment by simply make a bunch of money, guys, and treat your employees and your customers right, and I will go back to toothpaste industry analysis.
That's a good place to stop, I think. You know, next time we talk, I want to talk to you about Avid, which in itself is a whole other can of worms here, which should be very interesting. Anyway, thank you so much for being with me. I kept you a lot longer than I thought I was going to, and I apologize if I cut into your day, but it was just so fantastically educational.
Talking to you is not taking anything out of my day, but just adding pleasure. So thanks for having me.
Thanks, Eric. To find out more about Eric, go to ericgarland.co. That's Eric Garland, GARLAND, all one word, .co, not .com, .co. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOinnerCircle. I love seeing your questions and comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this together. He does a great job. Thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. BobbyOsinski.com. You'll find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.